Looking forward to this spot. I haven't talked to him in a while. He'll give us everything he's got on baseball. We got a lot to do on New England, the Red Sox, and everything else. Boston Sports Journals does a wonderful job for us. Good to talk. He's America's book critic, by the way. And he says hello, Sean McAdam. Sean, welcome. How are you today as we start hour three? How are things going, okay?
I'm doing okay, Chris. Doing as best we can under trying circumstances like everybody else. Good to talk to you.
Good to have you with us. Before we get to these latest proposals, let's quickly go through the Red Sox. Do you think the investigation was fair? Do you think the penalty was fair? What's your take on the second-round draft pick, the video guy getting suspended, and the whole ramifications, if anything, on the Red Sox from 2018?
Well, for all the time that Major League Baseball spent on the investigation, Chris, it does seem like a peculiar conclusion to come to, that there's this rogue lone wolf theory that JT Watkins, the video replay specialist, is the only guy culpable here. I think most of us expected that there was going to be, beyond the year that we all assumed he was going to get, Alex Cora's suspension, you know, there was the possibility of really getting hit hard because, of course, he was involved and very much involved in the 2017 Astros mess. And then you add this. So I think the fact that he got no more than, say, Lunau and Hinch in Houston was something of a surprise. The second round pick, I sort of thought that it might be something like that. You knew that they weren't going to get whacked as severely as the Astros did when it came to forfeiting draft picks because the offenses weren't as great or as deep as they were with the Houston organization. So that's not much of an issue. But, you know, the fact that this one underling, a low-level employee, and I don't mean to denigrate him. He's a guy that everyone recognizes as hardworking, and he's doing his job to try to decode things before and after games, whether he was doing it mid-game, which he strenuously denies, who knows? I just thought that the fact that they only penalized and disciplined one guy in the organization and not anybody in charge seemed curious to me.
Interesting. All right, so you think, I guess if you're a cynic then, you can make the argument that Manfred just wanted this to go away after the Astro disaster. And although there may have been a little bit more probing he could have done, based on where we are right now in the world, he figured he'd put this to bed and not go quite as thorough.
I'm not sure what the easy explanation is here, Chris, or even if there is one. I'm not usually one for conspiracy theories. I know some people are saying that Manfred didn't want to whack a big franchise like the Red Sox the way he did Houston. I don't think you can compare the two cases. I think it's pretty evident to anyone who's gone through the reports and seen what's been found that the Astros' malfeasance was far greater than that of the Red Sox. It just seemed like for an investigation that took more than 3 months and involved hundreds of interviews, to come away saying that the only guy that was in on this was the video replay guy is disingenuous at best and suspicious at worst.
Could he have? Now, he fined the Astro organization $5 million. He did not fine Henry, Warner, and that crew, ownership, anything. And I took the pick away, but no fines. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, a little bit, I guess, in that you want to send a message. And again, we go back to the repeat offender status that the Red Sox had, being that they were involved with the Apple Watch mess a few years ago. Granted, that was with a different manager. That was under John Farrell's tenure in 2016 and 17. The general manager or de facto general manager, president of baseball ops, Dave Dombrowski, is gone. But if you're John Henry and Tom Warner, you've owned the franchise for a period during which there had been two attempts to skirt the rules, however minor they may have been in comparison to some others. They had the Apple Watch thing a few years ago, and then this, and the organization Strangely, did get fined, though not a lot. I think it was something like $50,000 or $100,000 or something the last time under the Apple Watch issue, and didn't get fined at all this time. And Manfred's own words during the Apple Watch investigation was, you know, teams have been put on notice that going forward, this is going to be treated more severely. And then seemingly it wasn't.
Interesting. All right. Now, the interim tag was lifted from Renicky. I know the fans love Cora. The suspension is only through this year. I mean, is Renicky dead man walking? I mean, was Cora going to manage the Red Sox in 2021?
Well, that certainly has gained more credence in the last week since this was completed. And it's not hard to connect the dots and imagine exactly that scenario taking place. It's funny. It was sort of like a good news, bad news situation for Renicky when this came out. The Red Sox, the good news was the Red Sox immediately lifted the interim tag as they had suggested they would once the investigation was complete. But it was also revealed that Renicky's contract is just a essentially the same coach's contract he had with a raise in pay, and that is up through 2020, and that's going to start the obvious speculation that Alex Cora is just the manager in waiting, and whether 2020 gets played some in full or not at all, as soon as they can, the Red Sox are free to bring Cora back, and certainly they are free to, whether they will or not, remains to be seen. I think there are some lingering issues and some complications there, not the least of which the guy who should be making the call here, Chaim Bloom, the chief baseball officer, really doesn't have much of a relationship with Cora because they only worked together for a couple of months before Cora and the Red Sox mutually agreed to part ways back in January. So there's no obvious tie there, although it's clear that ownership and upper management loves Cora. I feel badly for Renicky. You know, here's a solid baseball guy who's spent 40 years in the game. He waited more than 5 years to get his second chance at a big league managerial job. He gets about two-thirds of the way through spring training. The game is shut down. Now there's no guarantee that this season is going to take place at all. And the writing is on the wall for them to go and turn back to Cora in a few months without him ever having managed a regular season game. And, you know, I like Ron a lot. I think a lot of people in the game do too. He may not be the magnetic guy that Cora is or doesn't have a World Series win on his resume, but he's a solid baseball guy. And the fact that, you know, in a best case scenario, he's going to have the specter of Alex Cora returning, hanging over his head for the next 6 months or so, it's unfortunate.
Good job, Sam, with Sean McAdam, and I agree with you about Renicky. He's a good guy. But I do think Cora, I think that, you know, you can make an argument. If they do play, Renicky will be singing for his supper. Now, we'll get to more of that in a sec. Let's do the play scenario. I'm sure you saw the article that came out. Bob Nightingale, who says a lot of wild things. I know baseball doesn't love him, and did indicate about the, you know, the play in Florida in spring training about a month ago. Now he's off that. He's into the three-tier division thing with the teams geographically being aligned properly and playing in major league stadiums. I'm sure that is something they've kicked around. We'll get to that specifically in a minute. Where do you stand right now? Do you have an opinion about whether baseball will be played in 2020?
Well, based on the reporting that Bob and, you know, a few other national guys, whether it be Jeff Passan with ESPN or Ken Rosenthal with the Athletic guys that certainly have good reputations, it's clear that in the last few days that the tide has turned among union and MLB officials toward a more optimistic approach that, yes, there will be some season that gets played in 2020. For how long and under what format and where remains to be determined. But increasingly, you hear an optimistic tone coming from these guys that there's a way to try to figure this out and that they seem motivated to try to figure out a scenario where at least, you know, 80 to 100 games can get squeezed in starting in late June, early July. But, you know, the details are where things get tricky. And I'm not talking about the setup or the schedule or how teams are grouped or whether you forget the American and National League. I think everyone is on board in baseball that you've got to throw convention aside. This is not by any stretch a normal circumstance, and anything that can be done to have some facsimile of the season should be, and that all options should be on the table. But it all gets back, Chris, to two issues. One is the health and safety of the players and those involved, and the people that would be sort of ancillary participants in this, whether that be clubhouse and equipment guys or stadium operations people and groundskeepers and all of that. You know, I understand that the players, a number of high-profile players, were very much against the whole biosphere isolation plan of Arizona, where you'd spend four and a half months there, going from the ballpark to the hotel and back again and nowhere else. I don't think players wanted to live like that, and frankly, I don't blame them. But this new plan where teams would, at least some teams, would be playing in their own major league ballparks, not their spring training homes, and obviously that's dependent on local health issues and guidance from medical and political leaders. It just seems like that would be a very hard thing to pull off in the country as it's currently constituted, to have plane travel, to have players staying in hotels for a few days and then moving on as if business were back to usual when clearly it's not. You have all those logistical issues to overcome. And once you get through all of that, and that's a significant hill to climb, then you're still left with one thing that's got to be figured out, and that's an agreement between the players in the MLBPA over salary and pay. And that's where I think you really could run into a roadblock. As you know, there was an agreement back in March that the players would be paid on a prorated basis so that if they played 81 games, they'd get exactly half of what they were supposed to over a full season. Players signed off on that. But the issue that's come up is the owners are now saying, well, that was negotiated with the idea that we'd be playing in front of fans, and clearly that's not going to be the case, or if it is, it's going to be reduced or phased in. So we have to make adjustments there, and the players are saying, well, you didn't say anything about that. We agreed on this deal. There was no provision for fans or no fans, so we have an agreement, and we expect you to live up to that. So even if baseball conquers all the logistical and health issues, and those are significant, then you still have to get this economic thing taken care of by both sides, and that's not going to be easy. So, and yet, in spite of all that, you definitely get the sense in the last week that there is increased optimism that some kind of season could get put together.
I agree with you on basically everything you just said. I will believe, you know, stadiums opening in California when I see it, because I've been reading with Jeffrey Smith, who's the Santa Clara County Health Examiner, Newsom, the governor. I mean, it just doesn't sound like to me the Dodger Stadium, Petco Park, Alameda, Candles, AT&T. I mean, I just don't get the idea that those stadiums are going to be opened. And this latest proposal Nightingale.
I mean, to be clear,
go ahead.
Chris, under this plan, at least initially, and we don't know, you know, we've heard the numbers anywhere from 10 to 15 major league parks. So some, and we can agree that, you know, both New York ballparks would be off the table, at least initially. The city has been the hardest hit. It would be too much to ask and put too much additional burden on the healthcare professionals and medical system there to risk playing there, at least out of the gate. So there's some, and I would imagine Fenway, given that, you know, I live in greater Boston, and Massachusetts, I think, is third or fourth on the list of cases and deaths to this. So Fenway would seem a stretch out of the gate. The question is, you know, where do you base those teams for a while? And while you're correct that there have been people in California saying you know, that they don't foresee any mass gatherings until the fall at the earliest, you know, does in the eyes of Governor Newsom and other officials, does 60 players and another 20 or so coaching and staff people constitute a mass gathering if you're not playing before fans? We just don't know the details.
Yeah, that's a fair point. If you're not going to have fans there, maybe they would open up the stadium from that standpoint. What is your – it sounds like baseball wants to get 100 and 110 games in come hella high water. Do you have a minimum? Now, I don't want to make this – I understand that there's going to be a gimmicky aspect to all sports when they reopen in the summer, NBA, NHL, and baseball. I get all that. But there does come a point where it gets to be ridiculous. Now, in baseball's case, I mean, if we get to August 1st and they got nothing done yet, and then they're sitting there, well, we'll play a 45-game schedule and we'll put everybody in the postseason and we'll play into Thanksgiving – that, to me, gets absurd, and that's what I don't want to see. Does Sean McAdam in his own eyes
– go ahead. And you're starting to hear timetables about ramping up to perhaps as soon as late June, early July. You know, under that scenario, with some doubleheaders, with some creative scheduling, you could probably have the regular season go through probably October. – So that gives you, what, July, August, September, October. There's 4 months at approximately 30 days each, or it's 120 days. Could you get 100 to 110 games played between July 1st and the end of October and then get the postseason into November, maybe even early December with some warm weather sites, some neutral sites, some retractable domes? Yeah, I think that could be done, but I think you're correct. I think at a bare minimum, Chris, you have to look at more than a half season. In other words, more than 81 games. And the closer you get to 100, the more representative of a quote normal unquote season you get. And that, I'm sure, is the goal. I think their aim is to get to or as close to triple figures in games, 100 games or more in the regular season.
All right. I don't like it. Do you have a problem if baseball plays, you know, games on Thanksgiving in the postseason and plays postseason games in neutral sites? I don't like it. Do you have a problem with that?
I don't have a huge problem with it. Isn't that, Chris, I think we have to concede that these are unusual times, and that, you know, that goes for the under the heading of understatement of the year. We don't know what the other sports are going to do. There's talk that, you know, the NFL is going to play its schedule as it normally would, but there's some suggestions that college football may move to the spring. We don't know if the NBA and NHL are going to pick up the regular season or go right to the playoffs. And then if they do, how quickly do they turn around on a 2021 season? There's so much up in the air. And, you know, ordinarily the prospect of watching baseball on Thanksgiving and whether, you know, would baseball take that day off and cede it to the NFL since there are three NFL games on that day and that's always been a game that's associated with football, maybe. Look, it's not perfect. It's unorthodox, to say the least. And it's going to, you know, for a game that is so tied to tradition and normalcy and history, it's going to be strange to have the Red Sox, Yankees, Mets, and Phillies playing in the same division. This is more than, you know, crossing over and playing a weekend series in interleague play. This is blending the leagues together. But I think, and I don't want to speak for others, but I would expect that most baseball fans would rather take that than nothing at all. And I think that probably applies to the things that we would have to adjust to. The World Series on the 1st of December in neutral sites, you know, playing on Thanksgiving, getting into an expanded playoff format this 1 year. Everything is up in the air, and at the same time, everything's on the table.
How much – I've been a little surprised, and I mentioned this, Sean McAdam, Boston Sports Journal here, helping us out with the latest baseball proposal. Well, I don't know if it's a proposal, idea, whether it's highly circulated, who knows, of having, you know, basically three divisions of 10 teams and, you know, playing them and maybe in Major League stadiums and getting away from the sequestered Arizona, Texas, Florida idea. I'm a little surprised how desperate these leagues, hockey, baseball, and the NBA, MLB and the NBA, they really want to. I did not realize that they had a play here come hella high water. I mean, you know, there comes a point you say, geez, this is big. This is a horrendous. We've played the 65 games in the NHL. We'll chalk it up to a bad year, and we'll see in October, and if we're lucky, same thing with the NBA and baseball. You know, geez, we're going through hula hoops to play an 80-game schedule and rapid testing and all. Why don't we just sit tight and we'll see you next year? That doesn't seem like it's any kind of option because of finances, Sean. And I am a little surprised that they appear to be that desperate for the TV money of all three sports. Does that surprise you at all?
I think you're correct in that take, Chris, that TV and, you know, perhaps it shouldn't surprise us because you and I are the same age and we've seen the transformation and how important TV has become. I mean, back in the 1960s, TV was an ancillary form of income. It was a way to help promote at least a little bit the game and show it to people and perhaps entice them to come to the ballpark. Now it is much, much more than that. In baseball, the game day revenue accounts for less than 40% of MLB's take. That includes tickets sold, parking, concessions, whatever you get out of the normal game day operation from fans. That's only a little more than a third of the revenue that baseball takes in, and this is a sport that did about $11 billion in 2019. So there's a lot of money that would be left on the table to TV rights holders if they played no games at all. Secondly, I think, you know, and this is another one of these how the world has changed arguments, I think all of these sports worry about being off the landscape for a year, particularly if the others are going to play. You know, if the NBA plays and the NHL doesn't, even if you might not have a huge crossover in some cities between those two sports, particularly when you get out of the northern cities, I think sports live in fear in this age we live in where there is so much competition for the entertainment dollar for your leisure time, whether it's Netflix or video games or movies on demand. All those things crowd into the marketplace, and if you're not there in front of your fans for a period of, you know, in baseball's case, it would be almost a year and a half between regular season games. I don't think anybody wants to disappear for that long out of fear that people say, hey, you know what? I went through all of 2020 without baseball, and I survived. So how much do I need it now? That's the worst thing that could happen. Another thing is, you know, baseball's got not only some lucrative TV contracts in place, but they're also trying to auction off a part of their national deal. The Fox deal goes for another 7 or 8 years. It's been extended a couple of times. But as you know, Chris, part of that division series and wild card and LCS is up for grabs. And they clearly want to burnish their brand and make sure that there's a bidding war when these rights get determined and auctioned off for the next time. And being, again, off the landscape for as much as a year and a half does not help in that regard at all.
Wow. All right, let's go back. Sean McAdam, we'll let him go here in a minute. He's done a great job. Let's go back to the negotiation aspect of this. I know Boris hated the first agreement. So you know he probably couldn't stand $170 million that the union got to pay for salaries through May 31st. And, you know, there does appear to be a little fogginess regarding, you know, what was implied in that agreement and what wasn't as far as revenue with fans. I would hope that both sides would be smart enough to realize if they quibble and get into a public discourse of how much these players are going to get paid when there's 40 million who have applied for unemployment and people have lost, you know, everything. Home, life, they can't go to college, they can't eat, everything. If these players and owners, I put them both in the same bucket, if they are that dumb that they don't realize the irreparable, they thought the 94 strike was bad. If they're that dumb that the players are going to moan and groan about how they should not have more reductions of their contract, and the owners are going to be that difficult about figuring out what they should get paid with no fans, you know, baseball is going to be finished. Do they understand that?
I don't disagree with you in theory here, Chris. And I would say if we were presented with this same strange scenario and worldwide pandemic as recently as 3, 4, 5 years ago, this would not be an issue. The relationship between the owners and the commissioner's office and the players and their union was for a very long time much improved. You know, they have gone some 26 years without a stoppage or interruption in play. The CBAs have become very smooth, for the most part, negotiations, not rubber stamped, but very little drama. They get done quickly and quietly behind the scenes, and they get announced, and it's peace in our time for the next 5, 6, 7 years. But as you know, that relationship has frayed considerably over the last couple of years, centering around what the players and the union believes is some collusion on the part of the owners, so that many of the top free agents, guys like, you know, we saw with Harper and Machado a couple of off seasons ago, having to wait until February and March before signing. So it's fair to say that the relationship is the worst it's been since that last stoppage of 94 and 95, and that's certainly influencing this standoff. And I would agree that the players risk beyond public ridicule if they dig in here and say that they need to be paid what their contract said and that no concession should be made and it should be prorated and nothing more, whether fans are there or not, will gain them no sympathy whatsoever. And you know that typically, and I'm not sure I've ever understood this, fans side with the owners for the most part on these issues. You would hope that cooler heads would prevail and that there would be some self-awareness on the part of the Players Association that these are not normal times and concessions have to be made. But I would remind you, in the history of labor and ownership struggles that date back to the 1970s, and you can like this or not like it, the players have seldom worried about what the public perception is going to be, and they have stuck to their principles whether you like them or not. So I'd love to think that ultimately, if they can overcome all the logistical issues, and there are many, that this would not be the roadblock that precludes a 2020 baseball season. I think everyone feels that. I'm just not 100% sure we're going to get there.
Wow. Do you think we'll have baseball in July of 100 games?
I hope so. And hearing what I'm hearing in the last week, it certainly seems it's moving toward that. But I would caution that there's a big bump at the end of the road when all the other issues get settled. And that is not going to be a slam dunk agreement on this matter of how the players are paid and for how much.
Sean, great job. We'll keep in touch. Thanks for a half hour today. Keep up the good work. Appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure, Chris. Good to talk to you. Please stay safe.
Okay. Our good buddy is Sean McAdam. Nice to have him with us as we talked about what's going on as far as the world of sports is concerned.